Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, the nation's justice correspondent, Elie Mystal, will join us to discuss his piece, People Can Only Bear So Much Injustice Before Lashing Out. We should tell you that what we've decided is we're giving everyone the entire podcast right now. If you are a member of the show, we really appreciate your support. In fact, we need it. It's the only way that we can do this show. But during this whole crisis that we're going through, COVID, and of course, the crisis that we now have in Washington, D.C., we feel it's really important that everybody gets as much information as possible, and we don't want to lock anybody out for money reasons. But if you are somebody who haven't lost your job, you're not worried about your financial situation, now would be a great time to support this program. We need you to support to keep doing what we're doing. Here to help us unpack the news of the week, Heather Digby Parton from Salon and Hullabaloo. First order of business, Digby, this week has been, I would say, one of the most disturbing weeks. Couple of weeks. It's very hard to sort of assess these things now. I mean, just because of my own mental state, frankly. And I think everyone else is out there. This, all the things that have come down today, and I mean, I should say this week and in the past couple of weeks. Sort of layer upon layer of things that are disturbing as the pressure of a society in the midst of a pandemic is showing all the cracks show up. I mean, it's as if, you take an inner tube with a bunch of holes in it and you submerge it in water and you start to see all of them bubble up. All those holes become very, very obvious. And I want to get into that. Let me just also just as a programming note, we could touch on this. We had a series of primaries this week, and coming up next week on Tuesday, June. Well, I'm not sure exactly what day it is, but coming up in the coming weeks, I think maybe New York is on June 23rd. We're going to have a whole nother round of primaries, and one of the races that has really popped is this race. I think it's the 16th district. Is it the 16th district? I think so. In New York, where Elliot Engel, longtime Democratic congressman, I don't know if I'd go as far to say a blue dog, but certainly a real block on a progressive legislature, and certainly very bad when it comes to Israel, and he has been. He was facing a couple of very strong challengers. In fact, we interviewed both of them, but one remains in the race, and that is Jamal Bowman. We interviewed him, gosh, it may have been 6 months ago now, and he is a fantastic candidate. He is surging now in that district, and the establishment Democrats are ringing the alarm bells. We will replay that interview that we did with Jamal Bowman, and we're going to put it on the free show so that everyone can hear it and head over there and support this guy, because we have a chance to get another, to build on what happened with AOC, who incidentally is endorsing Jamal Bowman. And so a great candidate, former, what do you call it? Principal at a Bronx middle school. And just a very sharp guy and a great candidate. We need more Jamal Bowmans, and hopefully he knocks off Elliot Engel. And Elliot Engel was caught on tape this week basically begging Ruben Diaz Jr. for a turn to speak in the midst of all these protests regarding the Floyd killing. And he's heard saying, like, look, I wouldn't care, but it's the primary. When he was trying to get on the stage, and bad attitude towards this, right? Yeah. Like George Floyd is not about your reelection chances. That's not why you should be up there talking about it. But be that as it may, Let's talk about everything else that's going on. I really don't know where to begin, except for I think it has to be around what happened on Monday when Donald Trump, having spent the weekend in a bunker in the White House, was so embarrassed by it, later claimed that he was just down there briefly inspecting the bunker. He was inspecting the bunker, Digby. Yeah, he wasn't in it. He was just inspecting it, because he goes down there occasionally to inspect it, because, you know, he's a hands-on guy. And
Obama didn't leave him any snacks. I mean, I heard somewhere that he's actually very concerned, because there were no snacks down there or anything, because Obama left them unsupplied. So he needed
Obama cleaned him out of, party checks or whatever it is. And he wanted to make sure that I had to go down there and make sure all the snacks were there. I was inspecting the bunker. I inspect all the. I mean, honestly, like you honestly can't come up with a better. A better excuse. I don't want to talk about this, but there was an alert that had nothing to do with the protests. We went down there. We quickly realized that the alert was called off, and then we went back up, something like that. But he didn't have the brains to say that. But so he was so embarrassed that they came up with a plan. And here's where it gets a little murky, and Digby, chime in here, because there is a New York Times sort of TikTok of how this went down. And frankly, I'm not sure I believe it. When you start to get these sort of like play by plays of what happens in the inner sanctum of the Donald Trump's White House, my first reaction is BS. Somebody wants to put out a story and they're giving it to the Times. So ostensibly what happens is they plan that Donald Trump is going to take a walk to a church that had a small fire after the protests had been boarded up. And he was going to take a walk there ostensibly to show that he was the law and order president. He was giving a speech about being the law and order president. And Bill Barr just happened to wander out into, to check out, to make sure that the walk over to the church is going to be okay, because everybody knows that's what the top law enforcement officer in the country does. He does the logistics for the security for the president, right? I mean, this story is just so rife with total BS. He saw that it hadn't been cleared, that there was a big protest there. And so he was the one who ordered all of these like array of military, quasi-military, federal police, quasi-federal police to essentially go in and rough up all of these protesters with bayonets, shields, bullets covered with rubber, and tear gas canisters, attacking media, peaceful protesters. One media guy said, there wasn't 98% peaceful people here. There wasn't 99% peaceful people here. There was 100% peaceful protest here. They brutalized people. They cleared it out. Donald Trump walked over there, held up a Bible that his daughter had in her knapsack, her $1,200 knapsack, and held it up. He was asked, "Is that your Bible?" And he said, "No, it's a Bible." And then walked back to the White House. And this is after he gave that speech and after telling the governors, you've got to rough up these protesters. Take it from there, Digby, because what we're seeing around the country seems to, like, those governors all got that message, it seems like.
Well, I think I'm glad you mentioned the governors, because that was sort of the act one of this whole thing. Obviously, Trump had spent the weekend, cowering in the White House. They did rush him down to the bunker. I mean, every journalist that reported that story says, look, we had many, many sources on that. What happened on Friday night, they breached some barrier around the White House. And the Secret Service, you know, whisked him, and apparently he and Pence had gone down there before to look at it in sort of preparation. We might have to bring you down here, Mr. President. But on Friday night, they actually did take him down. Excuse me. And he got a lot of bad press for that. When that was reported, you know, his nemesis in the media, you know, and on social media were calling him, you know, bunker bitch. And, you know, he was being, you know, he was being called a coward for running into the bunker. Now, in his defense, and I hate to defend him, but if the Secret Service told him he had to go down there, that presidents do that. You know, they go, okay, right. Well, if that's your judgment, you know, I'll go down. And that's all he had to say. You know, all he had to say was, hey, you know, this is the Secret Service. It's their job. They were doing their job. And, you know, we were down there for a few minutes and came back up. It's no big deal. And that would have been the end of that. But instead, you know, he made a bunch of excuses and obviously got very, very upset that he was looking weak. So they put together this call to the governors where he told them, you have to dominate. You've got to dominate. You know, you're looking like jerks. You're looking like fools. The world is laughing at us and all this. And the governors are all kind of sitting there, what the hell are you talking about? In fact, Governor Pritzker from Illinois, you know, kind of went back at him going, you know, this rhetoric isn't helpful. And the president said, well, I don't like your rhetoric either. You know, I mean, you know, it's like no puppet. You're the puppet. I mean, very, very childish reaction. So according to that TikTok, and I agree with you, I don't really understand what happened there. I don't know. There were a number of different sort of versions of it where was everybody in the room, including the Secretary of Defense and the Joint Chief, you know, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Milley, and, you know, Trump's new lapdog, O'Brien, his national security advisor, who apparently just worships the ground he walks on. Were they all in the room and they did this together? There was also a report that it was a smaller group that included Kushner and Mark Meadows and Ivanka, and that Ivanka is the one who came up with the idea of walking over to the church. I don't know what happened, but what we do know is that it was a photo op that was designed to show Donald Trump as a law and order kind of wartime leader. And he even had the chairman of the Joint Chiefs dress up in his battle fatigues, which never happens. They always wear their dress uniforms. They do not wear battle fatigues to the White House ever. And so they staged this whole thing. And of course, what you pointed out, which I think is really important about this idea that Bill Barr, who apparently thinks he's an actual general, not Attorney General, which is kind of a term of art, that he went down there and went, hey, you know, this doesn't really look that safe to me. I think we need to push these people back a little bit. Let's get that going because the president's coming down to make his speech, which he did in the Rose Garden, another ridiculous, silly law and order speech where he threatened to invoke the Insurrection Act, which would have been ridiculous, but, you know, he threatened to do it. But I don't think that's what happened. I think they always meant to push the protesters back in the moments before the president's speech because that's the demonstration of his strength, right? That's what they wanted to do. And so they had, you notice, I don't know if you remember it, but the cops or whatever they were some kind of federal agents. So they had military police, it said, on the front of their shields, outfit. Their RoboCop outfits. And then the other ones said Secret Service. And there were some others that were unmarked. Very ostentatious, you know, look to it. I mean, this seemed to me to be something they knew what the pictures were going to look like of them pushing them back. And when they did that, even when Trump was making his speech, you could hear the flashbang grenades going off in the background. So this was part of, you know, this was his rocket's red glare, right? I mean, this was his great heroic moment. And he walks over there. Well, later, and, you know, with the Bible, it was all ridiculous. And it was ridiculous in the moment, too, and everybody knew it. Watching it all over the country went, oh, my God, the holding up the Bible really just put a cap on it. I actually believe that may have been Ivanka's idea because she's just that lame. And, you know, at the end of it, in the next day, you know, we hear about they cleared out priests out of that church. They were sitting on the porch and these, you know, RoboCops came up and blew tear gas at them and everything. And the bishop from that diocese there was absolutely furious that they would do that, that they used the church. The next day, Trump and Melania doubled down and went up to this shrine to John Paul II, this Catholic shrine, and the Archbishop of Washington, the Catholic Archbishop, absolutely, that was one of the most scathing, you know, reactions
rebukes,
to
yeah.
his rebukes that I saw of anything. So this whole thing, it backfired on him. And it backfired on him because it was about his vanity being hurt, that he didn't look strong, and B, it was clearly a propaganda. It was photo op. It was campaign work. And in fact, at the end of the evening, they put out this ridiculous video of him marching to music, and they're all flanking him as he's walking. And Scott Walker, the former governor of Wisconsin, he tweets out, "What a boss!" You know, it's like, oh, you've got to be kidding. And nobody bought it. So I think it actually hurt him badly because Donald Trump is performing the job of president. He's not actually doing it. And that's going back to the very beginning. He doesn't know how to actually handle a situation like this. This is beyond his ken. He can't listen to anyone because he has a narcissistic personality disorder that won't allow him to actually, you know, take advice from people who might know better. So he went out and did this little performance, and I think it backfired on him badly. And in the middle of all that, you had this threat to use the U.S. military domestically, and I think that has now, we see with these remarks and statements by the former military leader, the former joint chiefs and other, you know, highly regarded ex-military, very, very high-level brass coming out and making some really pointed statements. That says to me that the military has said no. And, you know, they can't, the active duty can't say it. That's why the retired ones are saying it.
Right.
But I think they are reflecting the fact that the active duty military, when they heard Trump on the call to the governors and tweeting and giving his speech, that he was going to call in the military, I think they all kind of went, okay. You know, no, you know, we're not going to do that. And, you know, normally I am not in favor of the military not doing what the president says because their job is he's the commander in chief. But in this instance, Donald Trump was calling for them to, basically he was calling them to war, civil war. And I don't think that the U.S. military sees that as a legitimate function, and they consider their oath to the Constitution to go beyond the, you know, commander-in-chief
right.
ordering them to do that particular thing. They had to make that choice, and frankly, I'm glad they did it. So obviously something happened in there, and I don't think we know the full story yet, but there's a lot sort of leaking out. Esper, the defense secretary, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Milley, that whole thing is a very, very ugly kind of quasi, you know, or maybe I should
tracking.
Say altogether fascist kind of move that Trump was on the brink of making. And they at least for now, maybe it's only temporary, but for now they seem to have stepped up and said no, which,
tracking Esper's office is really, I think, where you see what you're talking about develop, because as soon as that call was made, as soon as the idea of the idea that they would use the Insurrection Act, and we should say it's been used before, but only in limited context, like not in a sort of like nationwide edict, right? They've used it in context like when you've got like Hurricane Katrina type of situation or Rodney King situation. Incidentally, Bill Barr at that time was the attorney general for George Herbert Walker Bush. Those are the situations, limited situations there, not sort of like broadly speaking protests all around the country. We'd say they're like, I don't know if there was hundreds of protests in terms of like, or hundreds of cities, but certainly like around 150, I think, have been recorded, maybe more, I would imagine, by now. But if you look at the Defense Department, you had, I think it was on Monday, shortly after that, or Tuesday morning, the Undersecretary of Defense, he resigned.
And, yeah, that's right.
It didn't get the attention that it probably should, but it's also something that never, ever happens in America. You know, that's like you hear the Europeans, that happens all the time, right? I don't agree with what the prime minister's doing. I'm resigning. I can't be part of this. In this country, you know, the idea of resigning, to maintain your integrity and honor is like it's a concept that nobody even understands, it seems like, in this country, right? I mean, it rarely, rarely happens. And particularly, you know, never with a high level, you know, super high level person, but this person is relatively high level. And then Esper, then you see the generals come out, and then Esper himself comes out and says, I don't think we should use the Insurrection Act, which was, you know, I think like you saw the military pushing back and saying, you know, don't get us involved in this. And meanwhile, Bill Barr is bringing what appears to be a mix of the Customs Border Patrol special units, the guys who are willing to do anything, apparently, various federal prison guards from around the country who are also apparently like, you know, trained to beat prisoners, essentially, are being brought in, like you say, dressed up in these RoboCop outfits with no badges, no insignia, no accountability. I mean, that is messed up. And, and I want to put a pin in that because there's really nobody to respond to that except for the press to some extent, and then an opposition party, which seems to be completely missing. But I want to just, there seems to me to be like two planes in which we can look at what happened this week. One is the trajectory of protests sort of that we've seen this week, you know, and you and I in particular, not just you and I, but we've seen a couple of like sort of like generations of protest over the past 20 some odd years. And I want to talk to you about that because I'm very curious as your thoughts about it. But I want to just stick with the what we saw out of the White House and what we've seen out of the Democrats, because it's fascinating. One of the things that has also marked, we've been doing this, this sort of space for some time, you know, back in the aughts when you were, a nascent blogger and I was a nascent radio host, the concept of hippie punching was something that we talked about a lot, and it would come very much from the center to the left. And it was a reaction to the McGovern era, to the late 60s era, and this idea that like America rejected, you know, the hippies and the peaceniks and all this, and anything that even remotely smelled of that, which, you know, in many cases it was not smelling of that. It was really more just like, you know, some type of partisan, like, you know, politics have changed, we need to fight, that type of thing. But anything that smelled of that, these folks ran for the hills. And that seems to be gone in this, right? Like, had we had this type of stuff, like, you could see the trajectory, you know, relative to like where people were with Occupy, right? Like, with Occupy, it was, subdued enough. You know, at first, like, the Democrats were a little nervous of it. And then they sort of, some of them embraced it. You know, Elizabeth Warren embraced it. And, you know, around, Pelosi came around for a couple of weeks to, you know, slightly embrace it. But that's also because it wasn't as much conflict involved in many respects. And it was in the wake of a financial crisis. And now it seems like we have come full circle where there doesn't seem to be this fear of, at the very least, of what's going on in terms of the protest. And I think part of that is a function of, and the country again is also, I think, like, they're siding largely with the protests. And I think it's a function of, like, to a large extent, white people getting marginally better, frankly, And, you know, younger people just sort of like having a completely different set of expectations. I'm not happy with what Nancy Pelosi is doing. I think there's a lot that she could be doing that she's not. But what they're not doing is going out there and saying we need law and order, which, you know, right, not that hard to imagine they would have said 10, 15 years ago.
They would have. I don't think there's any doubt about it. I mean, what you say is absolutely true. This was used, the hippie punching concept, was used as a way of establishing seriousness. You know, we're real leaders. We represent real America out there. And the way we are going to demonstrate that is by, you know, demeaning the left and, you know, and basically separating ourselves from that and showing real, you know, real Americans that we're on their side. And you could easily have seen that happening in a situation like this because it's been complicated. I mean, these protests, you know, the protests themselves, although in some cases, you know, there's been, you know, some violence and some, you know, confrontations with police and what have you. But really, these protests, you look back at the 60s and can compare it. It's nothing to that. They have been peaceful. They've been productive. They've been welcoming. They've been diverse. I mean, these protests have been great. Now, there have been these looting situations, which are separate. They're not part of the protest. That's something that's going on the side that's just sort of, you know, a kind of an opportunistic sort of thing. And in the past, I think that the Democrats in particular would have seen that, conflated it, and used it as a way to appeal to middle America. You know, like, look, we're not standing for any of this. You know, and basically echoing Trump's call for law and order, improperly so. And they're not doing that. In fact, they're basically, you know, for the most part, at least I haven't heard any of that. And including the media as well, which I also would have seen, you know, capitulating to the right wing, you know, liberal media screaming about media bias and all of that. They haven't been falling for it either. So I agree with you completely. This is there has been progress in that regard. There really has been. We're seeing a politics that on, you know, the left side of the dial, should say the center and the left, have moved much further to the left than they would have been even a decade ago. I mean, recall, yep. I mean, the biggest anti-war demonstrations in history, I think, were around the Iraq War, at least on a worldwide yep. basis, and they didn't even exist in the media. I mean, they were barely nope. even mentioned, and they were completely demeaned as being fringe, and there was nothing, and yet the numbers were gigantic. So this is very, very different now, and, you know, and thank God for it, you know. And you know, Sam, I mean, maybe the years that we've spent, you know, taking the punches, the hippie punches, maybe they've added up to something. I mean, maybe there has been, you know, there was some... We produced something, a little something here on this and helped move the country to a better place.
Well, one can hope and, you know, at the very least, it's a delusion that I will dine on for a while because, you know, I anything that is not alcoholic that can get me through this period would be great.
I hear that.
But it is fascinating, and I don't think we have time for it today, but it would be fascinating to sort of track the trajectory, because I've been thinking a lot about this, because there were protests. You know, we had the WTO protests in the late in 99 in Seattle, and then we had the protests around George Bush, his selection, and that was largely, I mean, literally hidden from people. And at the inauguration, you couldn't even see the people who the protests, and they were pretty significant. But then we had these massive protests in late 2002 and into 2003. Massive. 500,000-600,000 people in New York on multiple occasions. Similar numbers in Washington, D.C. I think there was similar numbers in L.A. and certainly around the world. But it was interesting. There were one-offs. Right. Like we had one on like a Tuesday, and then maybe it was like another one three, 4 or 5 weeks later. And then during Occupy, you had this notion of like sort of like almost like a rolling protest where these would go on for extended times, and it would be over the course of several weeks or months. And my sense is there has been a coming out of all of that sort of like pedigree or DNA. It's led us to this era where you have bigger protests, but also sustained over an extended period of time. And, you know, we saw this, you know, obviously we're coming out of the Black Lives Matter and Ferguson and all of those protests that were there. But the you know, and part of it's driven by just sort of we also have a younger generation that is big, is the biggest generation. You know, like the I haven't seen data on this, but I would bet that the that it is millennials who are out on the streets in the greatest numbers. And
I think it's Gen Z's too. And if you combine those two, the 18 to 24s plus the millennials, that's a gigantic number of people.
You know, you got to remember, like, the millennials are the biggest generation that exists now, right? They're even bigger than the boomers. And 20 years ago, we were that age and we just didn't have the numbers. And frankly, you know, I think like also I will say that in terms of like the part of this dynamic is that we know that millennials are getting married later. They're having children later. And the reality is like, I can tell you that were it not for my kids, my involvement in this would be very different. Just like, in terms of what I'd be willing to do out there. And I think that has a lot to do with it. I think people are just more engaged and more like it is very, very hopeful. And I just want to also,
by the way, we have 40 million people out of work. And I would guess that a number of those are people who are marching and, you know, not because they don't have anything better to do, but because they are in the midst of, I think, what everyone understands to be between COVID, between the massive unemployment caused by COVID and this absolute social, this justified social unrest around Black Lives Matter, we're in a crisis like something we've never seen before.
Yep.
I mean, I think this is really unprecedented. So people are out there because, you know, this is, you got to say something. You got to do something if you can. I mean, I agree with you. I mean, for young people, I mean, this is their life and this is their future. And they're looking at it and going, I've got to do something. I've got to be part of this.
And then I'm struck by the sort of the flip side of this coin of what we're talking about in the way that Democrats are sort of out of the specter of the hippie, the hippies, right? Like they're not as afraid of the street protests as they were. The flip side of this is that I think the White House has made a grave miscalculation. It's not just because Trump is a bumbling fool, although that's a part of it, but they are appealing to, you know, they're running Nixon's playbook. But unfortunately for them, A, it's a different country. The silent majority is not silent and it's not the majority anymore. B, Nixon was not in office when he ran that playbook. And so he could just, what Nixon was arguing for was not a crackdown. What Nixon was appealing to, I should say, was not a crackdown, right? And that may have been a tactic or an implied tactic. But what he's appealing to is the idea of like, we just want it to be normal and calm.
I'm going to fix this. We're
going to go back to the way things were. And we're not going to be, you're not going to turn on the TV and be worried about anything. Donald Trump is not doing that. Donald Trump is selling the crackdown and the law and, or, you know, the law part as opposed to the order part.
Right.
And because he owns the tactics in a way that Nixon never did, because Nixon was talking about these tactics hypothetically. And he was just, all Nixon could do was doing was saying like, this sucks, right? This is bad. This is all bad. Well, I'll fix it. But Donald Trump is saying like, I'm fixing it. And I'm part of the bad part. And that's the dilemma that they have, I think. And they've completely misread this. And the only thing that I would say at this point is that, like, there is a real danger. And you and I have been talking about this for 3.5 years. You know, Donald Trump, I think, is cosplaying, quite a bit in terms of the authoritarian thing. Like, he doesn't, I don't think he has it in him to sort of like go there unless it's a situation where like where he gets caught up in it, and which I also believe is possible. In other words, this isn't working, but he tries to double down on it. And and there's certainly people in that White House, I think Bill Barr is one of them, who is are happy to sort of midwife that. And we're in a very weird situation. And I agree with you about the military. It's like, you know, I think the military, the only upside here is, and I'm not asking for the military to do a coup or this and that, but
no.
At all. I want to make people very clear. And I am if to the extent that I could say, like, you know, what is my relationship to the military? I'm against it. You know, like, I don't know that we should have no military, but I am against the military as, you know, America practices it. Let's put it that way. And but it is at least encouraging to think that their attempt to create a federal police force, strike force, is inhibited by an existing institution, because there's only two or three institutions that we have that can push back on this. The press, which, you know, the New York Times is basically promoting Tom Cotton's perspective on we should send the military in.
Call to fascism, basically.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the New York Times is promoting that. And I don't care. Like, I'm sorry. We can find out what a sitting senator thinks. We don't need the New York Times to give its imprimatur to that.
I already knew it when Donald Trump retweeted Tom Cotton's tweets.
Right.
2 days ago.
I mean,
ago.
This was not news. Yeah, this is not news. And he goes on, incidentally, in that op-ed to basically write something that is completely unfact-checked. And so it's the press or the military is one, right? I mean, we don't have like labor unions in the way that we used to that could basically show up with baseball bats and protect the protesters in this hypothetical I'm working out. The military is one, and it's not, who knows? Right. I mean, who knows what?
Right.
You know,
we don't know. But
there's another one.
Okay.
And that is the opposition party. And as far as I can tell, they are still following the strategy of let Donald Trump, you know, do himself harm and don't get in the way. Well, you know, at one point, there should be something like where we say, like, oh, this could be bigger than the election, even. Or maybe the election's in jeopardy, or we need to make it clear to the American public. We don't leave it up to the military to say the Insurrection Act is inappropriate here.
Exactly.
We don't leave it up to, you know, bloggers and some dude with a podcast to say, hey, you know, federal police should have an insignia. We should know who's in command of them. There should be some form of accountability. Democratic accountability for who they're sending out to beat up protesters. Like, they're like, you know, we've said this like, I think like maybe a half a dozen times over the past couple months, but Nancy Pelosi better get that the entire caucus back in Congress in session holding hearings on this, and just every day saying, not Donald Trump's a bad leader, or Donald Trump doesn't know how to hold the Bible, or I'm going to show that I'm a better Christian than Donald Trump and I'm going to read something from Ecclesiastes or whatever it is.
Right.
But no, according to the Constitution, what he's doing is wrong. We need this from an opposition party, and we're not getting it.
Well, I mean, look, who did we see with the protesters this at any point from the Congress? The only two I know of, and there may be more, and if I'm being unfair to somebody, I'm sorry, but I saw Elizabeth Warren out there this weekend. She was with the protesters in D.C., and I saw Kamala Harris over the weekend.
Yep.
Other than that, yeah. You know,
I know AOC was headed down to the Manhattan Bridge the other night, according to Twitter,
and
that got resolved.
She tweeted it.
But Nancy Pelosi.
And I'm sure that those guys are. You know, I have a feeling that, you know, maybe I'm just missing, you know, AOC at the march in New York or whatever. But really, I mean, wouldn't it be, look, if we're going to have photo ops, how about a photo op with the entire Democratic caucus, you know, standing there in front of that fence, in front of the White House with their masks on, you know, holding up a sign. And how about them facing off those,
exactly,
those guys in the RoboCop uniforms? How about seeing something like that for a change? You know, you want to make a choice here? Let's see a choice. I mean, I think Biden's been out there. He went out and met with the protesters the other day.
Yep.
But, you know, the fact that they haven't, you know, kind of recognized their role here, and it is an important one. You know, I mean, we have to leave it up to some retired generals to point out that this is unconstitutional, what they're trying to do. I mean, that's bizarre, isn't it? I mean,
look,
you know,
I mean, all the data shows, and I don't want people to misinterpret what I'm saying here in terms of like some type of, you know, respectability politics thing about, you know, the violence or protesters getting into people's faces. There's nothing I've seen from the protests that comes even close to what I've seen from the cops. I mean, not even remotely close on in any fashion whatsoever. And but I will say that the data shows that in terms of public opinion and in terms of driving the body politic, the most effective messages to get out there are peaceful protests being met with disproportionate response by the authorities is the one that is the most effective. I mean, this is just, you know, this is the academic research shows over time and in many situations. And had there been a couple of Congress people in that crowd of people when Donald Trump and his thugs started gassing them and beating them and attacking them, had there been a couple of Congress people in there, you know, never mind the election, that would have dramatically, I think, impacted around the country, because, you know, you're having to deal with like memes on Facebook that Antifa is, you know, down the street and they've taken over the, you know, the local water supply or whatever, you know, like you're dealing with all of this, you know, people are politicking around this.
Yeah.
And the idea that the opposition party isn't out there saying what you're doing is wrong in a way that is at least saying like we're on the side of the people. Well, the way you show that is to get out there with the people. And,
exactly.
You know, you and I could go out there, but if that canister bonks us on the head or some cop comes up and shoves us, nobody's going to care. But if Hakeem Jeffries or I, you know, look, Nancy Pelosi, even if she's surrounded by security guards, which she can afford, is out there and they come at her like you've done more in that moment for this country than maybe what you've done in your entire career, frankly.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not picking on Nancy Pelosi in particular, but. Maybe. I don't know. But that's where they've got to be now. If they, you know, like we were fed all this stuff by them in terms of the danger to democracy. And it's like, hello, this is, you know, on that scale of things, like we're very close to where we would have to be if what you were telling us for a couple of years was the case. I mean,
absolutely. You know, I mean, and I think, look, I mean, there are plenty of them. For instance, the picture of those RoboCops guarding the Lincoln Memorial, which is one of the most grotesque things I've ever seen. It's like something out of a movie. Why not there? Why not go there and face them and say, I want to go up to the Lincoln Memorial. You know, I am the Speaker of the House, and these are my, this is my caucus. You know, we're all U.S. you know, Congress people, and we want to go up there. Are they going to stop them? Are they going to push Nancy Pelosi down the street? But, you know, there's symbolism in that, right? There's tremendous symbolism in that sort of thing. But they don't really seem to be interested in doing that. And I get, you know, COVID is out there. And I get it that for some of the elderly people, this is not, you know, being out in a crowd, breathing other, you know, that is a problem for them. But, you know, there are plenty of people in the U.S. Congress who could do that, who could lead that. And it wouldn't have to be AOC and the left. It could, you know, there are centrists, like you say, Hakeem Jeffries, be a perfect example. Of somebody, you know, you want to be leader, you want to be Speaker of the House, maybe, just, you know, get up and leave.
I mean, just
Hakeem
from a political standpoint, too. I mean, you know, like, you know, Hakeem Jeffries goes out there. I mean, I'm not encouraging this. I'm just saying that, like, it's amazing the political, the lack of savvy, right? Like, you can go out there, you can play your resistance card, right? And you can play your centrist card. And if you get caught up in this, but you're building credibility on the left, I mean, it's just like, this seems like a no-brainer to me, frankly. You know, I mean, if I was a centrist Democratic congressman or congresswoman, I would be out there and, you know, coming back and doing a press conference and saying, this is about democracy. This isn't about, you know, left or right, but as soon, you know, but being out there,
this is a time for solidarity, right? It's a time for showing solidarity on a number of fronts. It's not just a purely political, cynical political move, although I don't see the downside. I really don't. I can't see why this would be a problem. And the upside is huge, to be able to, you know, kind of show solidarity with the people and be willing. Look, people want somebody to face these people, to stand up to them, to stand up to Trump and Barr and the rest and their, you know, I don't know, they're robocops. I don't know what else to refer to them as. I mean, I guess, you know, I don't want to say brown shirts, but, you know, that's kind of what I'm alluding to here.
Right.
That, you know, they want somebody to stand up to them. And you know, this is what we have. It's politics. These are our political leaders. And, you know, we're looking for that. And it would be really nice to see. And, I wouldn't hold my breath though, Sam. I agree. That, you know, we're in the middle of, you know, a situation where they've just decided, well, you know, this is happening and we're just going to let Trump, you know, shoot himself in the foot. But
yeah,
you know,
let's hope he shoots himself in the foot and doesn't miss and hit other people. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about.
That's how it usually happens, isn't it? I mean, you know, he shoots wildly. Let's just put it that way. And there's a lot of collateral damage in that. And there's a lot of collateral damage in what's happening right now. This is setting a precedent. You know, I mean, it's like the New York Times putting Tom Cotton's op-ed in there, which you mentioned. Look, you know, I mean, like you said, he didn't need to be in the New York Times. I mean, everybody knew what he was thinking. And, you know, validating him in that way and putting the rest of the New York Times columnists on, you know, in this terrible position of having to, you know, somehow defend this or not defend it. I mean, it's a crappy thing to do to your people to put that in there for no good reason. But the fact is that this fascist strain exists. It exists in the Trump administration, even though it's a performance thing with him, but by which I just, as a digression, recommend to people to read Masha Gessen's piece in The New Yorker, if you can, which is about how he's performing fascism and what that means. And that's really important because the performance can lead to the real thing. And he doesn't know, you know, just kind of discounting him as being a boob who, you know, does a photo op and he's an idiot and whatever. That's all true. But by performing fascism, he's kind of setting this out there as a real thing. And a whole lot of his people, he's got a 42% approval rating, people that does not budge no matter what he does. Those people, if they did decide to bring the hammer down, if they did bring in the military, if the brown shirts or the robocops did start to take lethal action, those people would probably be behind him because he's the one who set that. So not countering that, not getting up and saying, no, you can't do this. This is un-American. You don't get to call in the military. All those governors. Why was Pritzker the only one who said anything on the phone that day?
Yep.
Why? Yep. Why didn't anybody else? Why weren't the rest of them? Why didn't Cuomo? I mean, you know, they came out afterwards, but that's kind of chicken.
Yep.
You know, why didn't they stand and go, "Hey, wait a minute, Mr. President, we don't do that in America. What are you talking about? Domination? That's not what we are. We're a democracy." You know, why didn't anybody say that? What would it have hurt? Would it have made him mad? I mean, who cares, right? But by not doing that, by continuing to show him sort of this respect, at least to his face, they in a way,
it encourages him.
This fascistic underpinning of everything that he's doing right now.
Exactly. It's like he's just, you know, it's like water, and it's going to flow downhill. And if you don't provide any resistance, he's just going to keep going because it's working. Well, Heather, who knows where we'll be a week from today, but we will reconvene and, stay safe, folks out there.
You too.
Stay safe. If you're out on the streets, be careful. There's a lot of resources for you before you go out there to find out what best practices are, making sure that you have legal aid numbers maybe written on your arm. Just in case, there's a lot of different things that you can do, ranging from, you know, carrying some Maalox and some milk, maybe,
yep.
you know,
wearing
having
masks.
A helmet,
just
wearing masks.
Masks.
Yep. All of this. Stay safe out there. Heather, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Sam. Thank you.
On Monday this week, we caught up with the nation's Ellie Mistel to discuss what was a tense weekend of protests around the country following the death of George Floyd. So, Ellie, here we are. It is, we should say it's at the beginning of this week, just coming off of a weekend where we had at least 24 cities where there were tens of arrests and there were mass protests across the country, some of which at varying levels became involved. You know, damage to property, but also a considerable amount of violence. And frankly, the vast majority of that violence perpetrated by police officers. I mean, the irony of people protesting police violence and, you know, broadly speaking anyways, and being met with police violence, I guess, it feels like it hasn't been lost on the country on some level. But give me your, let's start at the 20,000 feet view of really just, I guess, the past week.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of peak 2020, right, for police to be brutal at protests where people are protesting police brutality. You can't write that script. The 20,000 feet issue is that there has been a history of police brutality in this country that goes back, pick a date, like, 1691, 1786, pick a date. There's a history of police brutality that goes back in this country, and nothing ever seems to change to stop it. You can kind of get into the internecine like battles, like who wants what and what are they really protesting for. What people are protesting for, the ones who are protesting, is for the police to stop killing us. We want them to stop killing us. We want them to stop beating us. We want them to stop treating us differently than any other American citizen. And I think that these protests, what we've seen in the past week, they can't be understood without thinking about what we saw over the last month, right? Yes, George Floyd's death, horrible death, is an instigator, you know, is a flashpoint. Yes, Ahmaud Arbery's lynching is a flashpoint. In Louisville, the death of Breonna Taylor is a flashpoint. But you have to remember that everybody sitting here in this country has been watching the same news reports for a month. And we all saw white, predominantly white protesters with guns and Confederate flags going out there and protesting right in the cops' faces over, you know, not being able to get a haircut and not being able to go to the bar, right? We all saw that, and we all saw the restraint that the police exhibited. We all saw that, you know, protesters are pushing police into lakes and nobody's getting shot, nobody's getting pepper sprayed. We saw amazing restraint by the police for white protesters. And so when then you flip it around and you're out there not protesting whether or not you can get a haircut, but whether or not you can walk peaceably in your neighborhood without being harassed by the police, to then be confronted with police and riot gear, and, you know, who are throwing tear gas canisters and shooting rubber bullets, like, that is the milieu. That is the context under which some of these protests are boiling over and some of the anger is boiling over. We know the police can do better because we just saw them do better.
Right, right. That, I think that's a great point. The people can make the comparison, but it's also what it says about the capacity for police to actually deal with these type of protests. And certainly, I mean, I have that vision of, I guess it was out in California, of where the protesters were getting right into the face of these police officers and screaming at them and shoving them. And the cops are just looking there. They've got a complete poker face compared to a lot of what we saw around the country, where you had cops just almost aggressively trying to start something. And I think that's where we see that type of violence, or we see that kind of like the attacks on property. But we should also, you know, I think it's also important to keep in mind that we also have a situation, this ongoing pandemic, where not only has it generally put people on edge, but we also have a disparate number of Black people who are dying and getting infected from COVID-19. And it is one more example of both a class divide, but also a racial divide and disparity in society.
I'm so glad you brought that up, Sam, because one of the things with this pandemic that we've seen is unequal policing. Right. I saw a stat earlier this week. Right before I saw the video of the day that I saw the video of George Floyd, the beginning of that day, I was on a conference call about a new lawsuit that's being filed against NYPD for racial profiling during COVID-19. It turns out, based on the stats that we have, that so far in New York City, 81% of the summonses for, you know, violations of social distancing orders have been against Black and brown people in New York City. Now, let me tell you, I don't know what you might have heard, you know, if you live in Montana, but New York City is not 81% Black and brown, right? It is almost impossible to come up with that number of 81% of summonses against Black and brown people without kind of intentional racial bias in social distancing policing. So when you talk about the fact that we've been under kind of, you know, we're all on edge because of the virus, because of the pandemic, because of the, you know, social isolation, you also have to kind of put into this context that the unequal policing and the racially biased policing, that never stopped. That didn't take a break for 3 months while we were all hiding from the disease. Like the oppression that the police are willing to put on Black and brown people and on Black and brown communities never goes to sleep, never lets up. And that's part of what is the anger from that is part of what is boiling over this summer.
It's remarkably consistent, despite the fact that it's a completely different context, right? I mean, 3 months ago, the idea of policing people's social distancing did not really, well, I mean, I guess it's arguable, you know, stop and frisk on some level, you know, you're in a group of, but as a genre of citation did not exist. And the idea, there's many things I think that are being laid bare when society is under duress, right? As the tide recedes, it's quite clear, you know, who's beached and who whose boat remains afloat on some level, and we're seeing that across the board.
And we're seeing the pain and anger that comes out of that, right? Like that's an integral part of what of how to understand what we're seeing on the news and the pictures and the fires that we're seeing. There is a lot of anger that comes out of that disparate, unequal treatment for so long, you know?
Let's talk about, I mean, like I said, we're talking at the beginning of the week. And one of the things before I get there, is it your sense that when we see what we've seen on TV, right, there's we've got police departments set on fire. We have a couple of police vans. We have, a significant amount of property destruction. Apparently in Minneapolis, there's a really significant amount. I think there is some reason to believe that some of these instances are a function of people who are not really protesting with these protesters, but are rather trying to make it appear that the protesters are more violent than they are. But I think there's also a significant number of folks who are protesting who it's simply a reflection of their anger. And I don't think strategically necessarily this is the best thing to do in this situation necessarily. But I also it seems to me to be completely understandable under the circumstances that you would get this type of reaction, particularly in the way that the police in Minneapolis initially reacted to it. But is it your sense that there is that I don't, you know, look, it's very difficult to get a sense of what's happening in the suburbs versus, you know, in rural areas versus the cities. But broadly speaking, is it your sense that there is more sympathy or empathy for those engaged in protesting and those engaged in expressions of anger than we've seen in past instances?
I think that's a really good question, actually. I think there is more understanding of what is happening and why from white liberals than usual. Usually, once a fire starts, once the brick goes through the window of the AutoZone, that's usually when you lose many otherwise liberal white people, right? That's usually when you lose, you know, the kind of moderate centrist, you know, law and order suburban women who swing back and forth between Democrat and Republican, depending on who they want to have a beer with. Like, that's when you usually lose those people. And I don't perceive from where I sit and, you know, Twitter and Instagram and whatever, I don't perceive us losing those people right now. I perceive that people are a little bit more understanding of why it's happening. I'll give you another example. I wrote a post about, you know, not defending the violence, but explaining the violence, explaining the protests, explaining, like, why sometimes these protests do turn to vandalism or violence or whatever. I wrote a very similar post when I was much less well-known after Ferguson. And the hate mail I got after Ferguson was just like, oh, my goodness. It was like I had, you know, called for, you know, it was like I was the one calling for property destruction and damage, right? The hate mail that I've gotten after this one, not as much. I mean, some, but not nearly the same, like, level of vitriol, right? So I think that's another, at least, you know, kind of anecdotal indication that on the white liberal side, there is a little bit more kind of understanding of what's happening. On the white conservative side, I mean, they're doing their thing. Like, right. I think part, right, we live in a bifurcated society, you know, we live in two Americas, and, you know, what the MAGA people are sharing and interpreting and saying, they're in their own world over there.
All right, well, two things. One, let me just say, in terms of the AutoZone, you use that as an example. I mean, obviously, there's a lot more that's indicative of a lot of, you know, sort of the smashing windows. But the AutoZone in particular, there's some very strange video out there of an individual actually smashed those windows. People can find it, and there's reporting that's ongoing there where they're trying to figure out who that individual might be. It was a white guy with a black umbrella in a black trench coat,
man,
wearing a face, you know, a gas mask, and was acting It's a very strange way to go about that type of activity. Let's put it that way. But putting that aside, I just felt like I needed to mention that because I know there's people out there who saw that video who are like, wait a second. But nevertheless, the point remains. But since you brought up too the right's going to do their thing, I find it really interesting. I mean, you know, we hear a lot of calls. The line from the right, you know, and I call this from like my watching Fox and Friends, Lord help me, and other right wing talkers, and the president himself, and his representation, because the president really hasn't said anything, frankly. But they have been. There's two things that strike me. One is they're talking about, like, you know, peaceful protest is one thing. You can respect that. Of course, all of these same outlets, including the president, spent weeks, probably months, slamming Colin Kaepernick for exactly that. For the most peaceful, like, you know, a protest you could actually do. They spent slamming him. But they are not talking about this in terms of race. They are talking about this as if they are saying this is Antifa, as opposed to this is Black Lives Matter. And I'm curious as to why you think that might be. Is it just simply the election is coming up?
I think it's simply the election is coming up. I think that there is they feel like they get more steam here, making this a Democrat-Republican thing, making this a liberal-conservative thing, making this a law and order versus anarchy thing, then they do. They feel like they pick up more steam making it one of those things as opposed to a racial justice thing, in part for two reasons. One, they already got all the racists, right? Like, they don't need to emphasize the racial disparity here to convince on-the-fence racists whether or not to vote for Trump, right? Like, they got them. And B, they're not going to pick up any more white people by just talking about the racial injustice or pretending that the racial injustice doesn't exist, because everybody saw the video. Like, the actions are so, for George Floyd at least, the actions are so beyond indefensible that there are no votes to be gained defending the cop who murdered George Floyd, right? There are votes to be gained, again, in the suburbs, in these, you know, white bedroom communities. There are votes to be gained by making white people afraid that the rioters could be coming for you. And the best way to do that right now, I think they are perceiving, is to try to blame it on, you know, to basically make us Venezuela, right? To blame it on socialists or Antifa or whatever. I mean, Antifa is in a real, whatever made up word they come up with next, like that, they feel like there's more votes to be made there.
Yeah, people are calling, I saw some of the right wing talkers calling for the legal decapitation of Antifa. And I'm just wondering, like, who would they arrest? I've covered every, just about, you know, every protest on some level I've talked about on one of my shows that involved Antifa, and I could not name who you would decapitate, what that would constitute. And so I can't imagine they could either. But I want to just raise one other incident that took place over the past couple of weeks, actually past month, that we haven't talked about, that I think I wonder what your take is in terms of it changing slightly the attitude in the way that the elasticity of the tolerance for these type of protests, where in the past, I think you're right that there have been a certain segment of the center or center left or center right that was less tolerant of this, was the incident in Central Park with I believe her name was Amy Cooper, and I cannot remember.
Yes.
And I can't remember what his name was, but Amy Cooper was, yes. And he is a bird watcher, and he was going into the Ramble, I think it's called, in the Central Park, which is apparently an area that is specifically for bird watching. And they have specific rules about leaving, putting a leash on your dog. And she was in there without a leash on her dog. He came and said, would you please put a leash on that dog, and she really, really, really resented him saying that, apparently, to her, and began to actively threaten and then actually call the police and say, there's an African-American man attacking me. And she signaled to him, that's what I'm going to do. And she said, I'm going to call and say there's an African-American man attacking me. It got to the point where she started stepping towards him, and he was the one who said, please don't come any closer as he's videotaping. But she, it was basically, she's saying to this man, I know the disparity in policing in this society. I know that the threat of me calling the police, even when you know you've done absolutely nothing wrong, and I am the one who is, making an infraction, as it were, the threat to you is that much more, extensive, dangerous, and real. And I'm telling you now, I'm going to do it. And then I did it. And it basically was, we were sort of watching Emmett Till's story on some level.
We were.
And
I think where Amy Cooper plays in, and Central Park Karen, as she's been derisively called, I think where that plays into what we've been seeing this week is that, I want to say all the time, but a lot of the time, the kind of center-left, center-right types of people that we're talking about like to pretend, like to say, oh, I'm colorblind. Oh, I don't see race. Oh, race doesn't matter. Oh, we just need to live in a race-neutral society. Oh, we're living in a race-neutral. Like, they say all these, like, platitudes that are meant to suggest that they do not understand and do not accept that the inherent bias in our society, the inherent bias in our policing, the inherent racism that black people face every day. Amy Cooper happens right before the killings, right before the video of the police murder, and what that reminds people is that y'all can't lie. Y'all know this. You know in your heart. Amy Cooper knew in her heart what the threat of calling the cops meant to a black man like Chris Cooper, right? There's no denying that she knew what could happen to Chris Cooper, because it is the threat of what could happen to Chris Cooper constituted the threat that was involved, right? And so when you see an Amy Cooper video, as we all saw, again, just, days before George Floyd was murdered, what it takes away is this argument that was always false, that, centrists and moderates like to pretend that somehow we are living in a post-racial society, that somehow we should or are ready to move beyond race as a factor. We all know that's not true, and Amy Cooper kind of, like, doesn't let them lie now. Like, for a brief moment in time, Amy Cooper kind of took away their ability to lie about that just before they knee George Floyd to death.
I want to just get to one other thing in just a moment. But lastly, do you think that this is starting to aggregate? Like, for many, many years, there were these claims, and I think in many respects, like Rodney King was one of the, one of these sort of, breakthrough events where it was like, hey, maybe this is real, black people are talking about. And that, with the advent of cell phones, we have been just had, I imagine the number of these incidents has certainly not gone up, right? I mean, I think these have been going on for decades, like you say, in one form or another, since the founding of this country. But we have cell phones now. They are ubiquitous, and we are seeing more of this. And it's almost like, you didn't believe us before. How about this? And how about this? And how about this? And how about this? And on and on and on. And at one point, like, you see 30 of these, 40 of these, and suddenly you're like, I guess it's real. I mean, like, do you think we're at maybe that inflection point?
No, unfortunately. Right. No, I thought we might be there after Eric Garner. who was choked out in broad daylight on video. And nothing happened. Nothing changed. Nothing changed in New York City. It took us 5 years to fire the officer.
Right.
The reason why I say, well, the reason why I'm cynical and depressed about our ability to change is that recognizing that racism is real is really, that's a real, like, low bar. Like that is not nearly enough to get change. To effectuate change, you need people to not only kind of accept that racism is real in an ongoing fashion, like, you know, beyond the next week and a half, and change their actual behaviors, right? Change their voting patterns, change what they're looking for in candidates like district attorneys and mayors. Change their criteria for appointing judges. Have the judges change their criteria for issuing search warrants. And, you know, so like it's a systemic problem, and you need white people for the most part, because this is still a majority white country. It's very hard to do anything without a majority of white people in this country. You need white people to maintain that focus on this problem going forward for long periods of time, and there just hasn't been a lot of evidence that white people can kind of attach and dig in and hang in there for the length of time that we would need them to focus on this in order to get changes.
Ellie, you are the nation's justice correspondent, and so I would be remiss at this point if I did not ask you, even though I don't think that we have heard quite yet from the Supreme Court. But today, early this week, obviously, from when I think people are going to be hearing this, the Supreme Court was scheduled to decide on what, if any, of, I think, you know, double-digit number of cases, maybe it's 10 or 12 or 13 cases that could be a means in which to revisit the concept of qualified immunity. Qualified immunity was basically a legal doctrine developed by the Supreme Court in 1982 or 83, I think it was, that basically said that there has to be government officials, including police officers, have immunity unless the specific thing they have done has been found to be a violation, I guess, a statutory or a constitutional violation. Is that right? I mean, will you explain that concept to us and give me your sense of, like, what the implications of this are?
You basically explained it exactly right, that officers of the state, which include police officers, have immunity from civil liability for pretty much anything they do within the line of duty. You know, there are a couple of exceptions for when they clearly go outside the line of duty, but, like, making an arrest would be something in the line of duty. And if they commit crimes in the line of duty, like making an arrest, they are generally immune from any kind of further liability or damages for those actions. It is, as you said, it's been around since the mid-80s. It is, I think, important to say that this is an immunity that has been consistently upheld, not just by conservative judges, but by liberal justices and judges. This is a rare, both sides are kind of equally bad on this issue. And it is one of the core reasons why cops feel they can brutalize and sometimes murder people with impunity. They know they will never be charged civilly, right? So, like, if you're a cop and you're trying to decide whether or not you should break this guy's jaw or not, when you know that guy can't sue you, can't take your house, can't take your car, can't take your livelihood away, you're just much more likely to break his jaw. That's just how you're going. If you're already inclined to break the man's jaw, there's nothing left to stop you. You're not worried about any accountability for your actions. It's something that we need to change, but to change, you need to, I mean, first we have to get liberals to understand that it needs to, I mean, conservatives, that's like that's the master class. We need to get liberals to understand that this needs to change. And they are very resistant
to change. What is the theory that
You don't want cops. You don't want them to second guess themselves. That's been the theory since for as long as I've been aware of the thing. That's what's always been told me. That somehow, in the line of duty, under the heat of the action, you can't risk a cop second guessing themselves. They have to be able to act in the way that they see fit. And that, to me, it's ridiculous because, again, as a black man, no. I want the cop to second guess himself.
I was just going to say. Is there anything that sums up exactly what people want is the cops to in some way? And the interesting thing is that it's almost like society has been trying to push against a string. In other words, like we can go in and say you've got to take implicit bias training when, in fact, a lot of the times the issue is explicit bias. But what we need is accountability for these police officers so that they are coming in and saying we need training so that we can stay within the parameters that we now know are ones that we should not cross.
We need that. We need to break the thin blue line stuff is such a problem that I mean I think we kind of gloss over it. Like we need cops willing to call out other cops. Not first of all, we need them certainly in situations like now. And you are actually seeing some cops finally say like, man, that video seems wrong. But we need cops to call out other cops in real time. If you look at the George Floyd video, there were four cops there. Any one of them could have said, "Take your knee off that man," but none of them did.
Right?
It's like that. That is a key part of the problem. I say joke. I'm only half joking. I think that there are some situations where the entire damn department should be charged with RICO, right? Which charge under the organizational crime statutes that we have, because in some of these departments, every member of the department is part of the conspiracy to continue and cover up brutality. We have to find a way to break that. You know, that solidarity amongst cops where they won't stand up for what's right if a fellow cop is doing what's wrong.
Ellie Mistel, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. Stay safe and,
thanks for having me on. I'm still quarantining, man. I'm still, still trying not to get COVID.
Well, we can we'll check back in soon. I have a feeling many of us will be doing the same for a while. But thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam.
Ellie Mistal is the nation's justice correspondent, covering the courts, the criminal justice system, and politics. Of course, the force behind the magazine's monthly column, Objection. He's also the Alfred Nobler Fellow at the Type Media Center. Hey, folks, before we go, we wanted to re-air a special interview we had last September with an excellent progressive candidate. This candidate's challenging Elliot Engel, the longtime establishment congressman from New York's 16th District. Engel was caught this week on a hot mic after he said he only sought attention at a local protest over the death of George Floyd by saying, "If I didn't have a primary, I wouldn't care." Now, specifically, he was talking about an opportunity to speak to the crowd, but you can make your own assessment as to why a congressman should care about the death of George Floyd. So let's listen to our interview with progressive candidate Jamal Bowman, who happened to be endorsed by AOC this week. So, Jamal, you are another one of the challengers that we've had on, folks who are challenging long time, in many instances, establishment Democrats, Democrats who perhaps should be a little bit more reliably progressive in their voting. First off, tell us, I watched your announcement video. I thought it was very impressive. You're running in New York's 16th district. This is Elliot Engel's district. He's been there for 16 terms. You're an educator. Your math is probably better than mine, but that's 32 years. That's a long, long time. And so he has quite a record. And frankly, why don't you tell us what you think is sort of problematic with that record?
Well, what's problematic is the fact that it is a long time, and he hasn't used that time to build a movement across the district, right? So when you look at certain parts of the district, you see rent burdens as high as 57%. You see poverty reaching levels of 20%. You see homelessness running rampant in certain parts of the district, and you see an education crisis and an addiction crisis. So someone who's been in office for that long, you would think that they would be in every corner of the district working with as many people as possible to make sure we solve these problems. Instead, he's focused on one section of the district. He's beholden to and accountable to his corporate backers while ignoring the majority of the people in the district. That's unacceptable. I've lived in this district for almost 10 years. I've worked in this district for 10 years. I meet the people and I work with the people who have been most disenfranchised, and I know their plight and I know their struggle, and I come from the same places they come from. In the richest country in the world, it's unacceptable to have 15.5 million people living in poverty across the country. And in this district, we see it as being rampant. So there's a lot more work to do.
And I guess that's, I mean, you know, like, I don't know how much, and maybe you have a better sense of this. I mean, how much can a congressperson, who is obviously the federal position, do about, you know, the narrower questions within a district? I'm curious about that. The other thing that I think is more obvious to me is that if folks who represent districts like that are not laser focused on these problems, who will be across the country?
Correct, right? You have to, the district should be representative of the people in the district. And right now, Congressman Engel does not represent the majority of the people in the district. Any elected official, whether it's local, state, or federal, have to vote and work in alignment with their priorities, right? So someone in Congress, if they value peace over war, if they value people over profit, if they value schools and education over bombs and incarceration, that's what they will vote for, that's what they will fight for, and that's what they will push for. So as a congressional representative, I will use that position in that bully pulpit to scream from the mountaintops about a new vision, not just for the district, but for the country. Let's build more community schools. Let's close prisons. Let's focus on addiction, not as a crime, but as a health crisis that needs to be treated accordingly. Let's focus on peace in the Middle East and a foreign policy that looks at diplomacy more than we look at war. It's about being rooted in our humanity. And Congressman Engel has shown he is not rooted in humanity. He is rooted in profit. He is rooted in war. And he votes for things that decimate communities, like the crime bill, for example. So while I'm working in education, fighting against and stopping the school-to-prison pipeline, for a crime bill that's leading to the proliferation of private prisons and more incarceration, particularly in the New York State area.
And when you say that he's supportive of these things, that you, like you say, you mentioned that he voted for the 1994 crime bill, which, you know, to be fair, a lot of Democrats did. Some of the most progressive Democrats did. But many of them have at least come back out and said, mistake. He voted to deregulate Wall Street. I don't know where he stands on that today, but certainly the we had a 2008 crisis, which decimated particularly people in your district. I mean, I've looked at I remember looking at maps after the 2008 financial crisis, and Manhattan itself, no foreclosures, but in areas of the Bronx, a tremendous amount of foreclosures. Folks were hit really hard up there. And then, of course, he also voted for the Iraq war. I mean, I want to challenge you to say something positive, but it's very difficult because let me ask you this. The New York 16th, how blue of a district is this? In other words, is this a district that sometimes people say, well, it's one of those frontline districts, you know, you have to have someone who'll support, you know, George Bush's Iraq war. You'll have to have someone who will deregulate Wall Street. You have to have someone who's going to, you know, be super tough on crime. And, you know, even though there's racial disparities in this type of thing, we have to have someone who supported George Bush's horrible education program, No Child Left Behind, which we'll talk more about because you're an educator. Is this one of those districts where you have to play it safe, or is this one of those districts, like many in New York State,
that should be leaders of progressive ideas and issues around the country.
It is not a purple district. It is a deep blue district, and it has been for decades. So the leader within this district can be incredibly bold in pushing progressive policy and progressive ideology across the district and across the country. And as you mentioned, he has not done that. And to your point, you're right. Many Democrats did vote for the 1994 Crown Bill. The problem is they were wrong. And the reason why they were wrong, because too many Democrats, particularly moderate and centrist Democrats, have been beholden to corporations for decades while ignoring the people. This is why we got to get big money out of politics. This is why we have to deal with economic inequality in our country in a very serious way, in the same way that Bernie Sanders is talking about it and Elizabeth Warren are talking about it as progressive candidates. This is a deep blue district. It has been for decades, and he has not led. The thing we hear mostly throughout the district is we do not see him, he is not engaged, and it's time for a change. And those three things are what we're hearing as we've canvassed throughout the summer. And we're going to continue to hear that. And that's why we're giving the voters a viable option so that more than 7% of the electorate can come out during the primary, which is what happened in 2018, which is deplorable.
I want to go through some of the issues that you support and that you are promoting on your website. Housing as a human right. We don't hear much about housing, but we have a massive housing problem in this country, particularly in New York City.
Correct. So NYCHA houses 400,000 residents, and it's the largest public housing complex in the country. NYCHA has been neglected. It's under the jurisdiction of the federal government, by the way, and it has been neglected by the federal government for about 30 years. And funding and the opportunity to build new public housing stopped in 1999. So because of this neglect, you have rodent infestations. You have mold and mildew. You have paint that needs to get done. You have maintenance issues that have been neglected. So people are living in squalor, and people are suffering, and they feel neglected as a result of neglect from the federal government. So housing is a human right, and we promote and we push and we advocate for not just the revitalization of public housing, but the building of new public housing in alignment with green technology and equitable zoning that allows more affordable housing to be built in different parts of the district. We shouldn't have, when I go to the store, when I go to Rite Aid to pick up something late in the evening, there are people right here in Yonkers who are homeless, who are begging for money. That is unacceptable in a country that claims to be the richest and most wealthiest country in the history of the world. That is unacceptable for that to happen.
And on top of that, we have a problem with a lot of people aren't getting the health care that they need. You support Medicare for All. We hear Medicare for All a lot as a term. What does Medicare for All mean to you?
Well, it means that we will no longer have tens of thousands of people dying every year because of lack of health care. Again, healthcare is a human right. If someone is sick, they should be able to go to the doctor to get well. I mean, this is America. We claim to be the richest country in the world, and we have people suffering due to lack of healthcare. We also need to deal with the inequality and the racism that exists within the healthcare system as well. So when you look at something like maternal and infant mortality among developed nations, America is the worst. Because of the inequality built into the system. And when you look at black women specifically, they are 2 to 4 times more likely to die during childbirth or be victims of infant mortality. So it's Medicare for All to make sure everyone has health care, but we also have to deal with the inequality within the system.
When you say Medicare for All, because we hear a lot of people use those words, what specifically does it mean? I'm looking at your site. It says eliminate copays. Eliminate deductibles, premiums for all American. That involves vision, dental, mental health, long-term care, and you call for an expansion of Social Security. I mean, this is
absolutely.
Is there a bill out there that you think that you can support, Pramila Jayapal's?
Oh, absolutely, 100%. That was the bill I'm going to mention. It means free. It means single payer. It means the government takes care of it. We have the wealth. We should take care of the people in our country. And it's not about, you know, I often hear the argument that, oh, people want to keep their private insurance. People don't care about their private insurance. They care about their doctors and their nurses and the people that care for them. We're not talking about changing your doctor. We're talking about just making sure all expenses are covered, co-paid, surgeries, dental, eye, whatever you need. That's what we're talking about.
And I should say that you also support a restorative of justice, a Green New Deal. You talk about strong immigrant rights and LGBTQ rights on your website. But you're a principal of a public school. I want to talk to you about what's been going on with education really over the past almost two decades now in this country, where we have had a so-called corporate reform movement that has been largely, for the betterment, I would say, abandoned. The Gates Foundation came out with a report by Rand almost a year ago, basically saying, like, yeah, our whole idea was wrong. We made a mistake. That exactly. $1 billion that we poured into the system and caused everybody else to invest in that way, well, yeah, forget it. Our bad. We should probably listen to educators. Has the tide changed, or are we still feeling the impact of that completely misguided strategy about education?
We are still feeling the impact because children are still over-tested in our schools. We still have annual testing in grades 3 through 8, which no research supports that approach to closing the achievement gap or helping kids learn. So we're still doing that. The only spaces in which the tide is changing is where parents and teachers are fighting together against bad policy. Since No Child Left Behind, actually before that, since A Nation at Risk, 1983, Ronald Reagan, public schools and teachers' unions have been under attack. And it's all a scheme to privatize public resources. They're siphoning money from public schools, putting it into charter schools, allowing hedge fund managers to include charter schools as part of their portfolio as a way to build their wealth. So it's a private scheme to take public resources away from our public schools. The tide is changing because teachers and parents are working together and fighting against that. My vision for public education includes community schools, which is a very intense, explicit focus on early childhood. That's birth through age 8, making sure we're getting the resources to the families in the communities that have been most neglected, not just by education policy, but bad policy like redlining and things of that nature. On the other end, at the high school level, we need more trade schools. We need kids to work with their hands and build and design the new green technologies for the 21st and 22nd century. And in the middle, we need more progressive pedagogies like Montessori and Reggio Emilia so kids can become collaborative and self-directed learners. This is how we tap into their passion and their purpose and allow them to express their gifts throughout their learning experiences.
And then we should say now, I mean, the only upside, I think, to the Trump administration is that the siphoning off of these public funds has been it couldn't be more explicit. If it were up to Betsy DeVos, who basically has no problem with public schooling as long as it doesn't involve schools, just public money sent to parochial schools and private institutions. I feel like I could talk to you for about an hour about education, but we're running out of time. So let me just ask you this. What is your strategy? Like, you know, like it seems that AOC's defeat of Joe Crowley in 2016 has become a template for candidates like yourself. Give me a sense of what your strategy is to win this primary.
So we've been very lucky. From the very beginning, we've had over 400 volunteers sign up to be a part of that campaign. And right out the gate, we got out there and started canvassing in every part of the district, from Rye to Riverdale to Hastings-on-the-Hudson to Co-op City to Edenwald to Baychester to Wakefield. We're all over the district canvassing. We're conducting voter registration throughout the district. We're knocking on doors in public housing and places where people have been neglected. So throughout this summer, just in a couple of months, we have over 400 volunteers. We've knocked on over 3,000 doors, We've made over 4,000 calls. We're just out there and we're grinding and we're talking to all the people within the district. And if we can increase voter turnout by 40 to 45%, which we believe we can, we know we have a shot to win this thing. He's not going to outwork us. He may outraise us. He may hold on tightly to his base, but he's not going to outwork us. And these volunteers are riding the progressive wave that's happening, not just in the district, but across the country.
Well, people can go to bowmanforcongress.com. That's BOWMANFOR Congress.com to get more information if they want to help you out. It's been great talking to you. I wish you good luck.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for having me.
You can find out more about Jamal Bowman's campaign at bowmanforcongress.com.
That's it for this week's Ring of Fire. Like I said at the top of the show, we are basically unlocking our paywall. Not sure for how long we're going to do it, but for the time being, with all that's going on with COVID-19, all that's going on with Donald Trump's new authoritarian cosplay, we decided that we are making the show available to everyone. And if you are a member and you've been supporting this show, we want to doubly thank you. Thank you on behalf of ourselves and making it possible for us to produce this show. But also thank you on behalf of the rest of our audience who are listening. In many instances don't have the financial means to support the program. You are you're doing all of us a great service. If you are one of those people who do have the financial means to support the program, this would be a great time to do it. Of course, we had to take ourselves off the radio because of everything that went down with this pandemic. But you can head over to ROFpodcast.com, sign up, support the program. Don't forget, you can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. But that's ROFpodcast.com to support the show. And, of course, you can always, as always, check out The Majority Report. It's my daily show. We do it every day, live at noon. You can watch it on YouTube. You can listen to it on our app, or you can pick it up later as a podcast. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire Radio.
I was born. In a little tent, oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too. But I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know.